Dr. Paul William Poyser. Those of you who heard him last evening will know that you're in for a very stimulating and a very thought-provoking lecture. As you'll notice from your brochure, Dr. Poyser is a native of Amsterdam, Holland. He told us last night and reared in the Calvinist tradition of Holland. He received his candidacy in psychology at the University of Amsterdam and his doctorate in clinical training at Boston University. He is presently director of the education department of the Menninger Foundation. Those of you who admit to coming from St. John's, Winfield, will probably also recognize the import of the statement that he is consultant to the Winfield State Hospital and Training School. Without further ado, then I will introduce to you Dr. Poyser, who will speak to us on the psychological disciplines in theological education. Dr. Poyser.
Thank you, Mr. President, members of the faculty and students. Much has been written during the last decade about the relevance of certain aspects of psychology and psychiatry to the professional role and work of ministers. When one surveys the massive literature which has been produced in this area, one is impressed at first by its great topical variety, which ranges all the way from theological critiques of psychological concepts and theories, on the one hand, to pastoral counseling, on the other hand. From the psychological screening of candidates for the ministry, to how pastors might deal with grief work. From life situation preaching, to techniques of supervision in clinical pastoral training courses. In addition, some of the newer journals and magazines which devote themselves specifically to providing psychological and psychiatric knowledge to practicing pastors have come out from time to time with special issues on such crucial topics as divorce, mental retardation, sexual education, family relations, marriage preparation, alcoholism, homosexuality, and similar specific problem areas. But taking a closer look, one will also be impressed by a good deal of stereotypy. Perhaps for easily understandable reasons of felt needs and expediency, the overwhelming interest has been on the pastoral aspects of the ministry, with a concomitant interest in borrowing from psychology and psychiatry certain useful techniques and ad hoc theories, or little theoretical fragments only, of the various forms and knowledge and practice of psychiatry. Enormous emphasis has been placed on psychotherapy, particularly the individual kind, although group therapy up to a point has not been overlooked. Much of this literature has a sharp and definite problem orientation, like social work. Book clubs have been established to promote interdisciplinary reading and to offer shortcuts or at least non-technical avenues to understanding. But to the best of my knowledge, very little attempt has been made thus far to pull together the many strands I have just noted and to present broadly and systematically the spectrum of psychology which I believe to be relevant to theological education during the years of seminary training. I shall make an effort to do so after a few preliminary remarks. In the first place, it's good to realize that psychology is a discipline with many subspecializations. It itself maintains complex relations with psychiatry, with physiology, with the biological sciences, and with sociology and anthropology. I myself am a clinical psychologist, working, moreover, in a psychiatric institution devoted to treatment, professional training, and research in mental illness and health. This fact may color the views which I will express. And one of its first consequences is that I will use the term or the terms psychology or the psychological discipline or even personality sciences comprehensively to include psychology in the formal sense as well as psychiatry and psychoanalysis together with their various subspecialties and borderlands, and there are many. But I will exclude sociology with the exception of the disputed realm of the social psychology of small groups, which I shall, for convenience sake, count under psychology. My excluding sociology from consideration is chiefly dictated by practicality and by the fact that sociological knowledge and methods, in one form or another, and there are many forms for it, have already been represented in the curricula of most theological seminaries for a considerable time. It is also worth noting that the currently fashionable terms behavioral science and social science are often preempted by representatives of professions with a strong social and cultural orientation, but at the same time there's a bias against the study of individual psychodynamics. Since I am likely to give a prominent place to psychodynamics in the following presentation, I find herein another reason for leaving sociology outside of my focal concern, although I am, of course, very well aware of all kinds of linkages between the psychological, social, and so-called behavioral sciences. But a few preliminary remarks about theological education are also in order. My own involvement in theological education has only been part-time, consultatory, and by and large minimal. But I have had many formal and informal discussions with several seminary faculties, both collectively and individually, and I've had access to several professional reports on theological education, including the comprehensive mid-century studies in three volumes by Niebuhr, Gustafson, and Williams. I wish to make clear that I, as a clinical psychologist, will not be involved in defining the role of the pastor.
That is a unique function of seminary faculties themselves and of the churches which support them. But as a citizen and a psychologist, I am of course cognizant of the changing definitions of the role or roles of pastors, which are products of the changing cultural scene. And I must take these new role expectations into account, to say the least. Now, the various propositions I am about to make are stated only at the level of educational policies and educational goals. The translation of policy into the concrete details of the curriculum in terms of course hours, teaching techniques, and manpower distribution and acquisition is of a different order and must wait until the faculties reach decisions about desirable goals and the optimal scope of things. Similarly, I will not attempt to rank and rate priorities for the various aspects of psychology which I plan to review. The relations between one scientific discipline and another are usually quite complex, and one's judgment about them is likely to be affected by the value systems inherent in some assumed hierarchy of scientists. I simply propose here that we leave the question of who is handmaiden to whom to the Middle Ages. But in order to preserve the desired complexity of relations, I envisage four ways in which the personality sciences might be relevant to theological education. And they are the following four. One, as basic science. Two, as applied science. Three, as participant in an interdisciplinary dialogue. And four, as a form of knowledge and skill which might facilitate the personal and professional maturation processes of the future minister. Let me comment on each of these groups specifically and separately. And I begin with the personality sciences as a basic science in theological education. Now, what I emphasize under this heading is understanding, knowledge, points of view, conceptual framework, and so on, rather than skills or know-how. The personality sciences know something, and quite a bit really, about men in general as well as about individuals. And I assume that part of this knowledge may be helpful to theology as a constructive enterprise as well as to the situations and problems which pastors face in their various roles. For theology is just as much a man's science as it is a God's science. All theology, systematic as well as pastoral, has an anthropological dimension. I shall single out a few basic special areas here. First of all, the dynamics of crisis situations. Does a church this man as a whole at any moment of his life. There are nevertheless some peaks or depths in life which the church has always considered particularly challenging and critical. Such crisis situations as birth, death, illness, bereavement, marriage, vocational choice, disaster, war, conversion, entering into the church's membership, etc., present the individual with a specific problem or opportunity which tends to become highly individualized in terms of that person's history and psychodynamics. The theological understanding and formulation of such crisis situations might be enriched by the findings of the personality sciences. For instance, the psychodynamics of decision-making and problem-solving seems relevant. And what is traditionally called abnormal psychology would seem to have a very logical place here. Insights into the manner in which personality functioning might be disturbed and some knowledge of psychiatric syndromes and their dynamics would also seem to be helpful. The psychology of dying, hoping, longing, suffering, goal setting, pride, self-esteem, and their subtle dynamics are known to play a role in producing or giving special meaning to crisis situations. As a matter of fact, the very concept of illness itself, particularly mental illness, is open to constant revision and is indeed so much in flux that a review of its specifications would seem much needed. Similarly, for the concept of destiny, specific mentioning also needs the understanding of aging processes and attitude towards dying and death, upon which psychiatry and psychology are just now launching a rather strong and all-out research effect. You see, all these topics are not only important to the pastoral ministry, but are relevant to the biblical understanding of man, to doctrines of man, and to the relation between God and man. The heavy moralizing of the theological concept of sin exemplifies how far the church can go awry when its understanding of man is inadequate. A further subheading under number one, psychology as a basic discipline, is what I've called psychosexual relations and dynamics. And here I want to stress the psycho prefix. That is, the churches have expressed in the past much interest in sexological matters, and so has psychology. But in the course of study, it began to be felt that sexual drives and their derivatives cannot easily be dealt with as a compartmentalized area of life. The modern holistic approach in the personality sciences denotes a broadening of originally sexual interest to general theories of motivation and interpersonal relations. I think that this knowledge and these formulations, both in their narrowness and in their broad sweep, are important to anyone who wants to gain an understanding of persons. as a third subheading, that is, look at so-called educational psychology and the psychology of learning. Psychology of learning is nowadays a highly formalized psychological enterprise. But the larger conception, stemming from laboratory work, paired with the traditional body of educational psychology, remains relevant to all other psychological understanding of man. It is possible, and some people would certainly prefer it, to combine my first and second heading, namely the dynamic of crisis situations and psychosexual relations and educational psychology into the larger conception of so-called developmental psychology.
I think this is relevant to the body of the divinity studies in various ways. That is, the ideas of growing, maturing, becoming. The very notion of life as a journey, a la Bunyan or anybody else. The Kairos concept. The idea of stages of life. And the whole role that age factors might play in the appropriation of faith and its successive formulation are all very inviting to interdisciplinary exchange. The whole proposition of Christian education and its aims might benefit from exposure to the insight which the personality sciences have accrued in this specialty. There is a fourth subheading under one, and that is the psychology of religion. I personally, professionally, think very highly of this special field as a possible basic science to various aspects of divinity studies. Borrowing the title of one of Felix's books, I like to epitomize my views here by the phrase, dynamics of faith. Comparative understandings and studies on styles or typologies of faith, of the nature of conversion, of unbelief, of doubting, of the interplay between emotional, cognitive, and volitional processes in faith, and the psychological study of theological systems might well be discussed during theological education in order to deepen the student's understanding of faith and the understanding of the church and theology itself. I also think that this area in particular might have some very explicit relation to the field of philosophy of religion, if that is represented in the curriculum, and in some schools it is. But there is still one more heading under psychology as a basic science to theological education, and that is social psychology. Since I am speaking of the personality sciences rather than the broader behavioral sciences, as I said earlier, I'm advertently leaving sociology out of the picture. Its relevance to theological education might be stipulated or specified by sociology. And a cultural anthropologist might do a similar job for their field. The social psychology which I have in mind might be called the psychology of man in small groups, or the psychology of group relations, or if one wishes even, the psychology of interpersonal relations. And I think that its relevance to theological education is so obvious that I hardly need mention it specifically. The church is a group, and has groups. Its members interact with each other in various ways. The seminary
has many groups within itself. Preaching and teaching are group communications. Membership in groups requires a stylized or sacramental entering into or initiation process.
Now, let us turn to my second category, namely the personality sciences as applied sciences serving the functional roles of the pastor. Now, the emphasis here is not on understanding for its own sake, but in the service of helping and pastoral care in the broadest sense. As you would expect, there is here a concomitant emphasis on skills and the way in which these might be used by the practicing pastor. But there is, of course, always also a feedback from practice to theory, which in turn deepens or alters the understanding. In recent decades, the fields of pastoral work or pastoral theology have seen the relevance of the insights and skills of the personality sciences and have already appropriated much formerly alien knowledge in this regard. A relatively new term such as pastoral psychology or even pastoral psychiatry pinpoints this relevance. Now, I'm not endorsing these new terms, but they do serve purposes of exposition. I see at this moment three distinct areas which have already found their representation in various seminaries. And the first of these is psychology of group relations. Now, these are variously called group dynamics, or group therapy. Some people feel that there is also a group psychotherapy that has to be distinguished from the other two areas. Many churches and their pastors have found some knowledge of group processes and some skill in the organizing and running of groups a very important asset to their function. And I think they are right. It is an important aspect of all leadership development, which is perhaps the greatest perennial problem in all churches. Much of the modern pastor's work is with or in small groups. The session, board, educational groups, vestries, what have you. The pastor is also asked to participate in or lead groups outside his own church, such as ministerial alliances, councils of churches and their departments, etc. It is immensely helpful here to know precisely how groups are formed and become solidified, how groups tackle problems or dodge them, how groups stall in action, and most church groups do. How prejudices and personal feuds or misperceptions affect their efficiency. How groups foster or impede the individual's learning process. The second heading under psychology as applied science is individual and group counseling. This is, as you are all aware, an area of enormous popularity among present-day pastors, and deservedly so. It also ranks high on the list of many a pastor's preferences for certain roles or functions if he has a choice. This is also the area from which much feedback from practice to theory and back has led to ever more interesting reflections.
Many a pastor cherishes private, face-to-face contact with parishioners and deeply appreciates the atmosphere of intimacy in which he may relate himself to problem-laden persons. The pastor who is learning to preach must also learn to listen, which may be vastly more difficult. He must learn to relate himself to others directly and with sensitivity to the other's needs. And in this area, he must also learn not to become over-involved. There is an immense literature on this subject, and many now unsolved problems are being more clearly articulated day by day. One need not declare oneself in favor of any particular school of thought in counseling, and schools there are, to see the focal importance of still in face-to-face contact with problem-laden people as one of the most important assets to the ministry. A third subheading under Psychology as an Applied Science to Theology presents itself in clinical pastoral training. Many pastors have found it helpful to have spent some time of their training or career in agencies designed for the care or treatment of special groups, like the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, prisoners, people with physical or other handicaps, the underprivileged, outcasts, underdogs, what have you. As a matter of fact, many of these agencies are themselves the products of the church's own historical initiative. Let's not forget it. The special situations encountered in these agencies provide an opportunity for the minister to be close to certain depths of life, in whatever sense. They provide a first-hand observation of and involvement in suffering. In many such situations, the usual verbal armamentarium, and sometimes it is armament, and even the use of sacraments may need careful alteration in order to have any meaning whatsoever. But whether one engages in clinical training for a specialized ministry, for instance, for future chaplaincy in state hospitals or prisons, or for the sake of simply being a more effective, that is, better communicating parish ministry, one of the most important aspects of such training is that it brings the minister into close contact with himself in a just inward of way and with other professional people in the housing profession. This has both practical and theoretical significance. It opens up ways for the minister to use all the resources of the community in which he works. He learns to decide, and that's difficult, what persons to accept and what persons to refer to others for help. He also acquires an understanding in detail of gross and subtle forms of pathology, including his own. It may help him become aware of his own strengths and weaknesses, his special knowledge and skills, as well as his limitations. But he also as an opportunity to learn something about his non-possible colleagues in the helping profession, like psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, lawyers, and what have you. He can learn about their perspective, their strengths, their weaknesses, their shortcomings, their special views and skills, their fears. I see this as providing an interesting and much needed form of learning, a perspectival learning, a learning by comparing, so to speak, which may, in an oblique but powerful way, help the minister in formulating better his own aim, his own role, functions, and loyalty through personal participation in a subtle team process of give and take. Now let's look at the third item here. Psychology is a participant in an interdisciplinary dialogue with the body of divinity study. My premise to this special heading is that it is intellectually worthwhile and perhaps morally incumbent upon the members of the various academic disciplines dealing with men to enter into dialogue with one another whenever one can. Very deep problems need an interdisciplinary approach. Methodologies are usually studied best by interdisciplinary comparison.
We all know that relations between scientists are multiple and subtle. Most scientists assume that there is a hierarchy of disciplines. But the place of each science in the hierarchy is highly controversial. Academic specialization often comes about by taking an interest in someone else's discipline, but from a different perspective. It often takes place via a borderline science. But interest in another discipline is often defensive on our part, or produced by curious, non-cognitive motivation, as is the case in some special types of Christian apologetics, so-called, or, for that matter, in some sort of psychology. A fruitful dialogue is based on mutual receptivity, of expert listening, and a willingness to be trustworthy. Joyful, generous, and wholehearted edification is, or should be, the mark of any professional man. In this sense, almost any discipline might enter into dialogue with almost any other discipline. But I think that a dialogue between theology and a personality scientist has special merit. The immense concern on the part of many professions with what are variously called images of man, or doctrines of man, and one might as well add the more scientific term, theories or models of man, to the case in point. We have partial images, or sketches of man only, either, and we are all eagerly waiting for a more comprehensive image. I think this can summarize only by interdisciplinary effort. I also want to call attention to what is sometimes called Psychologie der Weltanschauung, the psychology of ideology. That is, the interdisciplinary study of ideology and of utopia and of cultural self-patterns and even of metaphysical systems. I think that methodologies and their possible effects on the subject matter studies are also an area of special interdisciplinary concern. For each science has its methodological blind spot. Finally, I need hardly
we say that philosophical and especially logical studies of the premises and the a priori and hidden assumptions of all disciplines are always in order, and we should welcome them. And now to turn to my last category, number four, the role of the personality sciences in fostering the personal and professional maturation processes of the future minister. Let us start by considering and acknowledging that vocational choices are deeply rooted in the personality structure and highly affected by social dynamics. And the choice of the ministry is no exception. The call to the ministry, though presumably affected by some transcendent arrangement as well, is by no means an exception to this rule. Each type of professional education has its special glories and hardships. Again, ministerial planning is no exception. Problems of intellectual doubt, of emotional affirmation, of ethics and professional soundness, and an unfunctional demand which the congregation and the world place upon the minister. Plus the minister's own conscience and ideals and motivations, they are all potential hazards and hardships. If there is some truth in the popular belief that ministers crack up, many people in other professions do too, this could warrant the validity of a search for all the special factors that play a role in this experienced hardship. But even if the popular assumption is not true, the educational process will be better when the faculties have a clear knowledge of all the potential pitfalls, problems, threats, and challenges that come before the minister to be. I would hold on common sense grounds that the appropriation of the theological curriculum demands much more than cognitive bluff. It demands also emotional affirmation and conviction and existential decision, which seem to go well beyond the adoption of analogous attitudes demanded in other disciplines. In all health and professions, learning involves some degree of attitudinal change. Thus, the students need more than courses and seminars, and most seminaries usually much more. Advice, counsel, and personal example given by the faculty are very important. To have a sensitive view of students is very important. Yet it may be that much more of these, if not for most, than at least for a sizable portion of the students. Many students might need a more clearly set of therapeutic relations, even when by common standards their problem is not to be defined as ill. The practical answer to this problem area will be determined by many considerations, but I do believe that a visiting psychiatrist or psychologist working in cooperation with the dean of students might be a very important link in this chain. At the end of this brief overview, which could have been made with greater differentiation, but which carried already in each of its sections a special rationale for doing what was recommended, one may now with new vigor inquire about the basic reason for the relevance of the psychological disciplines to theological education. Why should seminaries engage in all these non-theological activities and subjects? Isn't there already enough to teach and to learn within the very limited time span of 3 or 4 years?
Aren't these proposed items pure luxury? Or indulgence in liberal arts? Or merely optional enrichment, such as are available in some lucky divinity schools, which are part of a large university in which all the arts and sciences are represented? My answer is an emphatic no. The psychological disciplines are not to be introduced into the seminaries as luxury or as optional selections from the liberal arts. Without denying the importance of a liberal arts education anywhere and at all times for anyone who can take it, I believe that the psychological disciplines have a very special relevance to theologians and pastors because of their particular content, their particular method, and their particular skills. And I also believe that psychology is a discipline of enormous potency to anyone who deals with men at the level of depth and the persistence of concern that has always been characteristic of theology. As a matter of fact, I even believe that it is in a unique position to vie with theology for a supremacy in some hierarchy of science. Can be a powerful ally, a keen competitor, an invaluable critic, a bitter enemy, or a wise friend. In any case, it is a neighbor with whom one should be well acquainted, even if one wants to maintain distance from him.